don't think we need to have major doubts about whether or not eternal inflation is the answer to our problems. I think it answers many more questions than it raises. And my feeling is that we will hopefully be able to solve this major problem. But let me take things one step at a time. This is the outline of what I really want to talk about in today's talk. First, I want to describe why it is that almost all models of inflation lead to eternal inflation. Then I'd like to talk about some of the theoretical benefits of working with eternal inflation. The independence of initial conditions, for example, which I think, from my point of view, has a lot to do with answering Neil's questions. A possible explanation for the small vacuum energy density, which I don't think we have a good explanation for otherwise. And then another problem I'd like to talk about is the avoidance of a thermal equilibrium phase. And I think I'll have to explain what I'm talking about when I get there. But I believe that most models of cosmology lead ultimately to a permanent thermal equilibrium, which just does not look like the world that we see. So I think we have to avoid ever getting there. Finally, I will talk about the measure problem, which I agree is a problem, and I'll try to give you something about my take on the problem. Can't give a talk about inflation without showing this slide. I was glad Neil showed it also. There really is a lot going for this idea. We still need to understand it better, of course, and inflation is certainly not a completely detailed theory by any means. So there's lots to be understood, but there's clearly something that says that we're on the right track. Getting on now to the issue of eternal inflation, I think one of the reasons for believing that eternal inflation is a very plausible idea is that inflation itself is very successful in explaining what we see, and that almost all versions of inflation, in fact, lead to eternal inflation. The crude explanation is simply that inflation takes place when exponential expansion occurs as the universe is in some kind of a metastable false vacuum state. The false vacuum state decays, but it decays exponentially, and in general, if you have a successful version of inflation, that exponential decay has to be slower than the exponential expansion, and that's all you need. If that's the case, then the total volume of the inflating region will be the product of those two exponentials, and will grow with time rather than diminish with time. So the bottom line is that in almost all versions of inflation, once inflation starts, it never stops. But instead, the inflating region continues to grow, and pieces of it undergo decay and produce these pocket universes, and it goes on literally forever. And my view is that we need to understand that, not decide that we can't understand it, so it must not happen. I don't see that point of view. In slightly more detail, if we just consider our own universe, our own pocket, even there, we're clearly threatened with the possibility of eternal inflation. We now know that our universe appears to have a positive vacuum energy, a positive lambda, and that means that we are now entering a phase of exponential expansion. If our vacuum is stable, then we go on exponentially expanding forever, and we're certainly in a phase of eternal inflation. If our vacuum is stable, we might still allow tunneling up to higher energies and then tunneling back down, but that's still eternal inflation. It's, of course, possible that our vacuum is metastable, but if it's metastable with some kind of an exponential decay rate, then we will still enter eternal inflation unless that rate is reasonably fast. If the decay rate of the universe is not on the order of the present Hubble constant to the fourth power, if it's smaller than that, then we'd be in the same situation as one normally talks about for eternal inflation, where our vacuum would be decaying, but it would be exponentially expanding faster, and we would still be in a phase of eternal inflation. So the only way to avoid eternal inflation, even within our own pocket, is to have a decay rate which is relatively fast compared to what we might expect. To describe how different models of inflation lead to eternal, I'll start with old-fashioned new inflation, where the inflation takes place with the scalar field sitting on top of a plateau. This model is, I think, the one that's most clearly a model which leads to eternal inflation. The scalar field sitting on top of the hill will, of course, if you look at it in any one place, eventually roll off. But you can calculate what the probability is that the scalar field remains at the top of the hill at any given time if you model the theory as a free theory with just an upside-down quadratic potential. You could solve that problem exactly. And it leads to the answer that you might expect. The probability of remaining at the top of the hill falls off exponentially with a time constant related to the mass of the upside-down potential. And as long as that's slow compared to the exponential expansion, which it really has to be to have a working model of inflation, then this model becomes eternal. The volume at which the scalar field sits at the top of the hill just grows exponentially forever. For chaotic type inflation or large field inflation, it was shown by André Linde in 1986 how these models become eternal. It's a little bit more subtle than the other case, and perhaps therefore something you might argue about more. But I think the crude argument which André gave originally is very convincing. He said, let's imagine the scalar field rolling down the hill, and let's describe the quantum fluctuations stochastically. And the easiest way to do that is to imagine thinking of everything as in terms of Hubble units. When you talk about the scalar field, we could talk about the scalar field averaged over Hubble size. When we talk about taking time steps, we could take time steps of Hubble size. And in that case, one can think of the quantum fluctuations as just giving a random jump on top of the classical evolution, which has a magnitude that's determined by the only parameter in town, the Hubble parameter. It's of order h over 2 pi. That means that you can follow the system starting at some phi equals phi naught for one Hubble time. During that Hubble time, the universe, by definition, enlarges by a factor of e cubed. That's the one statement I'm making that you really cannot argue with. And that's about 20. You can't really argue about that either. And what that means is that if the probability of the scalar field going upward when you add this extra quantum jump is more than a 20th, then the volume where the scalar field is as big as phi naught will grow with time instead of decrease. And that's the basic mechanism for describing eternal inflation in these chaotic models. And generically, any power law potential will allow that to happen if you go up high enough, and most other shapes will as well. It can be avoided if the potential rises fast enough, but it has to rise very fast to prevent this from happening. So generically, these models also lead to eternal inflation. On my next slide, I think I have a picture of what eternal inflation might look like as a schematic sketch, which I think is useful to keep in mind. What I've shown here is a universe that's evolving. I use ordinary time, not conformal time, going upward, and spatial co-moving coordinates going left to right. I've also simplified the model significantly, perhaps, by considering only bubble nucleation. In principle, in an eternally inflating universe, one has really two things going on, or at least things that are going on that you can categorize into two categories. There's bubble nucleation, which is what's shown here, but there's also just the stochastic evolution of scalar fields, which can roll up and down hills quantum mechanically. And that I've left out just because it's much, much harder to draw and much harder to know exactly what it will do. What characterizes the picture, though, is that the space is growing exponentially as one goes upwards. These are co-moving coordinates. So there's much more volume at the top than at the bottom. And therefore, there are just a few bubbles that form near the bottom and many, many more bubbles that form near the top. Also, if you look at any one bubble, the walls go up in curves that straighten out, and that's just caused by the scale factor. The scale factor makes the speed of light. The walls move essentially at the speed of light, but the scale factor makes the speed of light have this shape that levels off. And of course, it asymptotes at the horizon, which is controlled by the exponential expansion. So that's what the eternally inflating universe more or less looks like. Next on my agenda, I now want to tell you about these theoretical benefits that I would claim for taking eternal inflation seriously. The first of these is the independence of initial conditions. Now, I have to admit that the independence of initial conditions depends on your choice of measure. I'll talk about the measure problem later, but we're all aware of it. Not all measures actually lead to independence from initial conditions. But many do, and in fact, all the ones that I really like do, partly because they make you free of initial condition dependence. But in any case, the point I can make here is simply that eternal inflation at least allows the possibility of formulating theories where what you expect to see as a consequence of those theories is independent of any assumptions you might make about initial conditions. And I think that's a nice feature. We don't know it has to be that way, but we can build those theories and we can see if we can build theories like that that work. Second item I want to talk about in terms of theoretical advantages is one which has already been mentioned, namely the opportunity to use anthropic arguments in a way which I think really does make them totally believable in the context. So it was initially pointed out by Weinberg that this cosmological constant or vacuum energy that we observe that seems to be 120 orders of magnitude smaller than it ought to be can be explained very nicely if we accept it simply as a selection effect. This idea is enhanced by the ideas coming out of string theory that, in fact, the fundamental laws of nature might very likely possess many, many different vacuum-like states, long-lived metastable states. And if so, if there are 10 to the 500 or more, then we would certainly expect, just doing statistics, that there'd be a huge number of states which would have vacuum energies as low as what we observe. So then the only question is, would we be likely to be living in one of those vacua? And if you believe that life preferentially forms in vacua of very low energy density, which is also a rather believable statement, then in fact the whole problem is solved. You conclude that most, if not almost all, living beings in your model universe would in fact see a very, very small vacuum energy like what we see, even though most of space would be filled with vacuums of vastly higher vacuum energies. Finally, this is the one that I think is least well known, and as far as I know, there's not really any paper at all that addresses this problem completely. But I want to talk about this thermal equilibrium phase, which I consider to be a bugaboo of many cosmologies and avoided very nicely by the idea of eternal inflation. The point is that if we imagine a universe, which is the opposite of eternal inflation, if we imagine a universe which is described by some finite quantum system or some classical system with a finite available phase space, then the system will reach thermal equilibrium. And once it does, it will just start to undergo Poincaré recycling forever. Now, that would be fine if we could believe that we would be living only in the approach to this equilibrium and that nothing would happen once equilibrium took place. If equilibrium were empty, no problem. We can tolerate in any cosmological model arbitrary amounts of emptiness without posing any problem to our idea that the theory predicts what we see. But unfortunately, that's not what happens. And this really was an issue that was first talked about by Boltzmann long, long ago. In thermal equilibrium, there are still thermal fluctuations. In principle, the system is just going through all possible states. And all possible states include states with living things in them. A living thing is just a state of the system, unless we think there's something magic about biology. In that case, many living things will also exist in this Boltzmann phase, in this thermal equilibrium phase. And in fact, the fraction of living things which live in the equilibrium phase will always be one, because we'll have only a finite amount of time approaching thermal equilibrium at most, and then an infinite amount of time hanging out in thermal equilibrium. So if the theory takes that form, I think there's hard to see how to avoid the conclusion that essentially all life should be life that exists in a thermal equilibrium phase. Now, what does the thermal equilibrium phase look like? What I would claim is that it looks nothing like the world that we see. Everything that we've learned from the time we were in kindergarten about how we understand the world is based on understanding the world through what we believe to be its history. when we're talking about cosmology, it's this Big Bang history, which allows us, for example, to calculate things like the relationship between the helium abundance and the age and the temperature of the cosmic microwave background. But none of those relations have any reason to hold if we were living in thermal equilibrium. In fact, there are clear reasons why they would not hold. So it was pointed out by Dyson, Klebin, and Susskind back in 2002 in a paper that was really discussing de Sitter space, but I think has much wider implications, that, for example, if you imagine a world that looks exactly like everything that we see around us, but the CMB happens to have a much higher temperature, say 10 degrees, to pick a number, if you're just doing state counting, there'd be many more such states than there are states of the type that we think we see with a 2.7 degree cosmic background temperature. 10 degrees? Nothing. Well, I'll increase the Hubble constant a tiny bit. I mean, as you know, it's a very tiny bit. Not exactly like ours, I agree. Well, there's nothing exactly like ours but ours. I don't know how far you want to push that argument. That proves that we live in the only possible world. Done. I think that idea has been proposed already, but not considered highly scientific. Right. Right. Locally it changes, I suppose, but only very locally. Well, anyway, I think most of us agree that the world that we see around us looks nothing like thermal equilibrium. When we try to calculate what we expect to see next, we always base it on our historical models and never on state counting. And I think we're all well aware, despite Neil's half objection, I think we're all very well aware that the world that we see is not in any way resembling a world that we would predict if we were simply doing state counting. So this is the problem. And the point is that eternal inflation very nicely gets around that. Because at least if the semi-classical global picture of eternal inflation is valid, the picture where we just keep forming more and more bubbles ad infinitum, in that picture, new pocket universes are constantly being created. And every time a new pocket universe is created, we're exploring a new region of phase space that we've never seen before. So this is a model with an infinite phase space. And wherever you start, you just keep marching onward and onward into new regions. No Poincaré recycling, no thermal equilibrium ever being established. And I believe that it's really the only way that we can account for the world that we see, something like that, thermodynamically. For this to happen, I point out that we, of course, need for the physical theory to allow an infinite classical phase space or an infinite number of quantum states, if that's the case. So whether or not our ultimate notion of fundamental physics will be consistent with this, we certainly don't know yet. But I would say that cosmologically, there seems to be, from my point of view, pretty strong evidence that the right theory should be one that allows infinite marching through phase space without ever recycling. I think not. If you're restricted to a finite portion, then you start going around. And once you start going around, then it's just state counting on that path. So I could be wrong, but I don't see how to get a world that looks like what we see if you're confined to a finite box in phase space. Well, no, initial condition doesn't solve this problem. The initial condition only can make a certain amount of time before you thermalize, but then you still spend an infinite amount of time thermalized. And that thermalized state will have people just like you and me. They just won't see the same things that we find ourselves seeing. Right? Remember, there will be Boltzmann brains, you would call them, in this state. But every state's happening. So every state that involves you and me keeps recurring every time there's a Poincaré recycling here. But our surroundings, on average, will be thermal equilibrium surroundings, not looking like the Perimeter Institute. So as far as I know, the only way to get out of it is to somehow destroy the world after you start to reach thermal equilibrium. Yes?
Just to push that one a little bit further.
Go ahead.
In that ensemble, with overwhelming probability, when you all their memories of the past are overwhelmingly likely to be false.
Right, and the prediction for the future is also overwhelmingly likely to be false. Right. Is that right? You agree? Right. I agree. I think that stronger version is I would agree with. So I think this is a very important point, which I think strongly constrains one's notions of how cosmology should work if one buys it. Eternal inflation. Will. Well, in fact, we'll give you a toy model, but it's a very toy model. It doesn't really illustrate all the features, but in fact, that is more or less where I was going next. But of course, you know, full theory of eternal inflation still does need to be formulated. That's certainly true. I'm just suggesting that if the semi-classical version of it that we can talk about now really works, it does get around all of these problems. As far as toy models, to show that just as sort of a proof in principle that what I'm saying makes a certain amount of sense, I'm really addressing here a slightly different question, but I think it really subsumes the other question. An important question, I think, is, refers to a statement Neil made, can Hamiltonian evolution, consistent with Liouville's theorem, lead to the fine-tuning of parameters? Neil made the statement in his talk. I'll have to ask him what he meant by it exactly. Do I have it here? Yes, he said Hamiltonian evolution almost never turns a generic state into an unusual state. What was the almost in your... Okay. I claim your statement is just plain blatantly false as long as one considers systems which have infinite phase spaces. For a finite phase space, what Neil said and what Roger Penrose has been saying is true. Time evolution merely pushes the probability distribution around in phase space, and whatever is rare in one time is rare at any other time. But I claim that that's a completely misleading statement if one wants to talk about systems where the phase space volume, where the available phase space volume is infinite. Then I think it very definitely is true that Hamiltonian evolution, consistent with Liouville's theorem, really can result in the fine-tuning of parameters with probability that can go up to 1. The difference, in both cases, you're pushing things around in phase space, but in the finite phase space system, if the phase space your system occupies is small compared to the total, it's definitely rarer and stays rarer. With an infinite phase space volume, any system that has a normalizable distribution has a phase space volume which is infinitely small compared to what's available, and it stays that way no matter what. But that doesn't really distinguish any particular distribution from any other anymore. Every distribution has infinitely small phase space volume compared to the total. So let me give you an example of what I'm talking about. The question again is, can Hamiltonian evolution result in the fine-tuning of parameters? There are lots of examples. My favorite is one that was invented by my son, Larry. Larry, by the way, is rapidly becoming one of the hot young mathematicians in the country. He just, at age 33, he just accepted a full professorship at the Courant Institute at NYU. But anyway, I asked him to invent me a Hamiltonian that would have this property. Now, it's easy to invent Hamiltonians that have this property, by the way, but I wanted one that was bounded from below and time independent. If you allow either of those to not be the case, it's trivial to make up examples, but I was not capable of making up an example that had both of those properties. But my son only took a few minutes, and he came up with the inverse tangent of minus PQ. Minus sign is just because I want to fine-tune Q rather than P. Plus sign would work just as well. This is time-independent and bounded from below. And if you work out the equations of motion, those are them. Now, these look a little complicated, but the thing that makes it really simple is that PQ is the Hamiltonian, and therefore is conserved along lines of evolution. So you can think of the denominators here as being fixed for the motion of any system, just determined by the energy. And then what you really have is Q dot is minus a constant times Q, and P dot is plus a constant times P. So P grows exponentially, Q decreases exponentially. And that's true no matter where you start. So for this system, you can make an incredibly strong statement about fine-tuning. I think it's the strongest possible statement you could ever imagine making in your wildest dreams. You could say, you give me any probability distribution whatever. The initial conditions could be anything, as long as it's a normalizable probability distribution. And I think all probability distributions have to be normalizable. In that case, you could then choose an epsilon and choose a delta in the usual epsilon-delta fashion, make them as small as you like. And for any such choice, I will be able to find some time, capital T, such that for any time later than that capital T, you may have to wait a long time, but for any time later than that capital T, the probability that Q lies outside of the magnitude of delta can be made as small as, can be made as large as you want, excuse me, 1 minus epsilon, as close as you want to 1. So you can fine-tune as precisely as you want by making delta very small. You can fine-tune with as high a probability you want by making epsilon small. And no matter what choice you make, this can be satisfied. So this, I think, is a fine model showing how Hamiltonian systems can indeed cause the fine-tuning of parameters, which is just what we observe in the universe and just what we always thought inflation does. As long as there's an infinite phase space available, a Hamiltonian system can do it. Now, at any point, you have the multiverse might not be a Hamiltonian system. I have no knowledge about that. But what I'm saying is that even if it is, we still have no problem understanding how it can result in fine-tuning of parameters that we observe. Okay, interesting and important, actually. I'm glad you raised that point. This system, and I think very likely most systems like this, I would think most systems with infinite phase spaces available, fine-tune in both directions. So if you run this backwards in time, same equations, but now the dots really kind of have opposite meanings. If you run it backwards in time, it's P that's fine-tuned. So either way, you get the fine-tuning. Now, with this toy model, you can't really talk about entropy, or at least I don't know how to talk about entropy. But I think you can also easily believe that if I had a more complicated system where the concept of entropy made sense, maybe it does here, but I haven't figured out what it means exactly. I think the system's so simple you don't really have any coarse graining, so I think entropy will always look like it's conserved. But if you have a more complicated system, so the concept of coarse graining makes sense, then I strongly suspect that you could start with a generic system with, again, a generic initial condition, and that if you follow it to the future, it will start to spread in phase space, and depending on the Hamiltonian, could fine-tune some of the coordinates. The spreading, I think, is automatic, and you would interpret that as increase in entropy in the ultimate future. And if you follow backwards in time, it might contract for a while or might do anything for a finite amount of time, but if you follow back far enough, it will start to spread again in the past in the negative time direction. And you'd end up with two universes, each of which would have a growing entropy, and each of which would have come from a much smaller region of phase space, because the beauty of an infinite phase space is that any finite size region is small compared to what you'll approach in the far future or far past. I just wanted to mention something amusing. I'm not going to claim that this proves anything, but Neil spoke very glowingly of the work of E.T. James in his talk. E.T. James wrote, what I gather is a fairly well-known book on probability theory and also wrote many papers. I don't know how many physicists are aware that from the point of view of quantum mechanics, E.T. James is a heretic. He does not believe in quantum mechanics, and he thinks that we're all idiots for believing it. If I can read you a footnote from his book, the footnote appears in the section about superstition. He's basically saying that quantum mechanics is like superstition. And after describing this, he says that in the meantime, progress in human knowledge continues to be made by those who, like modern biologists, do think in terms of physical mechanisms. As soon as that premise is abandoned, all progress ceases, as we observe in modern quantum theory. So he's convinced that the only reason, in fact, he says this rather explicitly in another place, that the only reason the world looks probabilistic to physicists is because we just haven't worked hard enough to figure out what makes things really tick. Just thought I'd point that out for the amusement of it. Okay, onward. What do I want to talk about next? I did want to come to the measure problem. How much time do I have left? About 15 minutes. Okay. I can be pretty leisurely, I think. First of all, just to remind everybody what problem it is that we're talking about here, as Neil quoted me as saying, and indeed I did say it, and I guess I'm about to say it again, in an eternally inflating universe, it is indeed true that anything that can happen will happen an infinite number of times. That, by the way, seems, as far as I can tell, to be true for cyclic models as well, so I'm not sure why Neil makes such a fuss out of it. But it is a true statement, certainly, for eternally inflating models. And therefore, it's essential that we learn how to separate the probable from the improbable if we're going to make predictions, because the most improbable things happen an infinite number of times, and things that we consider probable also happen an infinite number of times. When you have an infinite set, it's generally speaking ambiguous what fraction of the elements have any particular property. And the classic example that's used by almost everybody here is the question of the integers and the question of what fraction of them are even. In the normal ordering, 1, 2, 3, 4, it certainly looks like half of them are even. They just alternate I even. And you can even make that rigorous by counting what fraction is even up to some n and then taking the limit as n goes to infinity. That is rigorously a half for the integers in their standard order. But it's ordering dependent. So you can take the same set of integers and order them 1, 3, the first two odd numbers, then 2, then the next two odd numbers, 5, 7, then the next even, then the next two odd, then the next even. And that list will incorporate every integer exactly once. It is a list of the set of integers, just in an unusual order. And if you look at that list, it looks like 2/3 of them are odd. And indeed, if you try to define that rigorously by going up to n and taking the limit as n goes to infinity, it'll be completely rigorous that 2/3 of those integers displayed in that order are odd. So the actual fraction is undetermined. It depends on how you measure it. And that is the problem in the multiverse. We can, of course, regularize the multiverse by introducing some kind of a cutoff, exactly as I did by introducing the n when I was talking about the integers just now. But just as when I talked about the integers, the answer we got depended on how they were ordered, in the multiverse, the answers we'll get will depend on exactly what kind of cutoff we choose, which will determine how the different events in the multiverse will be ordered when we count them that way. So there is a clear dependence on what appear to be arbitrary choices at this point. And that's certainly a problem which we need to somehow or other learn to reckon with. And that is what's called the measure problem. The measure problem is the problem of defining probabilities in an eternally inflating universe in an unambiguous way. Or more precisely, it's a prescription essentially for regularizing the volume integral, the space-time volume integral, which would, in a finite universe, you would just integrate densities with integral d4x through g, and you'd be able to count anything and get an unambiguous number. But in the infinite multiverse, those integrals will diverge. Any direct counting will diverge. And we need some kind of a prescription for what it means to say that one type of event is twice as likely as another. There'll be much talk on tomorrow, I guess, on different kinds of measures that have been proposed. And therefore, I was not planning to talk about it in any detail today. But I will try to explain what do I have next. Where am I going? I will just talk in generality about how I view the nature of the measure problem. One point I'd like to make, which is controversial, so I'll admit that's controversial at the start, is it does not look to me as if the problem can be solved simply by using the wave function of the universe to describe things rather than using classical physics. Ultimately, by the way, I think most of us do think that hopefully this problem will have some kind of a quantum solution. It doesn't appear to have any classical solution, so the hope is that quantum theory will in some way or another regularize things. But if by quantum gravity one is simply talking about a formalism which gives amplitudes for space-like slices, which is my understanding of how the wave function of the universe works, so maybe only a partial understanding, then it seems to me that the problem that we're talking about is still there. Namely, if one describes a situation where eternal inflation has set in, then a typical space-like slice that goes across the multiverse will have on it an infinite number of observers. And if you talk about the results of any experiment, there'll be an infinite number of those observers who the wave function will tell us sees X, and the wave function will tell us that there's also an infinite number of observers who see Y. And the question of what fraction of observers see X versus what fraction of observers see Y is still left unanswered. So it is, I think, you know, very possible, and I even hope that somehow a quantum understanding will ultimately lead to an answer here. I don't think that merely describing things in terms of a wave function of the universe is enough of a change to get rid of this measure problem. I think Jim disagrees with me, and we'll hear from him later in the week. He'll tell us. Maybe we'll talk about this. I don't know.
Yes, I will say something about this.
OK, good. Good, because I'd like to hear it, so I'm sure we all will. Okay, so I did say this is controversial. There are different sides to it. Okay, what I want to focus on, I think, for the rest of my talk is the question of whether or not we should consider the measure problem to be a showstopper in terms of eternal inflation. Should we take it as an indication that somehow it must mean we're on the wrong track because we've come up with this intractable problem? I don't think so. It's a matter of opinion, and you're allowed to have your own opinions on this. Since the problem is unsolved, and I can't tell you how to solve it, I can't guarantee you that it's something that's going to go away and not ultimately become an unsolvable problem. But at the present time, I don't think there's any reason to give up about eternal inflation. There's just reason to study the measure problem, which is what I and many people are doing. First of all, I want to point out that the description of the multiverse itself is not a problem. The measure problem has nothing to do with describing the actual multiverse. And Vitaly Venturin and I are writing a paper, which really will appear soon, we claim. We've been telling us that to each other very emphatically this week. So I think it's really going to happen. And we'll describe in some detail in that paper how one can statistically describe the multiverse. I don't think this contradicts anything anybody else has said. The multiverse itself is a well-defined statistical system. The point is that you can imagine, just to make things well-defined, defining the whole system on a lattice. And if you make the lattice spacing coarse, that should be OK. I'm talking about a classical or semi-classical description, so I'm not trying to do quantum mechanics that I don't really know how to do. And I'm imagining that the laws of physics are given to me by somebody, because we're not questioning whether or not we understand the laws of physics. We know we don't, really. We're questioning simply whether or not this process called eternal inflation is possible to describe. So I'm going to imagine that we know the laws of physics, and then we can describe the whole system on this space-time lattice. The space-time lattice has to grow exponentially with time to accommodate an exponentially enlarging universe, but we can let it do that. And then we can define, in principle, by using the laws of physics, an update rule that will tell us the n plus 1 step on the lattice in terms of the probabilities for the nth step. This is an evolving probability distribution that we're calculating. And as long as the laws of physics define that update step, we claim that the system is mathematically as well-defined as the mathematical properties of the integers. The integers are, in fact, defined in essentially the same way. You define the infinite set of integers by using the piano axioms. And the key axiom that makes the integers infinite is the axiom that says that every integer has a successor. And similarly, we would have essentially a successor rule, which tells us how to go from time n to time n plus 1. And once one imagines that that rule is in place, our claim is that the mathematical system describing this multiverse as a statistical system, as a stochastic system, is just as well defined as the set of integers. It could be. It depends on how you put the rules in. Since we're latticizing it and so on, it will only be at best an approximately Hamiltonian system because the lattice will, I think, break the Hamiltonian format. Can be. It depends. I mean, we haven't specified what laws of evolution we're going to use here. We'll use whatever laws you tell us. So if you give us laws of evolution that are Hamiltonian evolution, then it will evolve according to Hamiltonian evolution. That's right. And by classical stochastic, what I mean, it has to be kind of invented as we go in detail, but I mean that classical physics will work most of the time, but will allow for random nucleation of bubbles and will allow for random occurrences to happen wherever else we think they're probable enough to affect the macroscopic world. Yeah. No, it's not semi-classical gravity. No, it's not semi-classical gravity in that sense. Yes. Well, they will really be collapsed to begin with. The bubbles will form stochastically, certain probability per time per volume. And as soon as they form, they'll cross objects in this formalism. Yes?
I think what Neil might worry about is it sounds like the actual space of possible states is increasing with time, so it would be hard to have some underlying being built in your dynamics.
Oh. Okay, okay. No, I agree that that's a problem. And I think a conceivable answer, but I have no idea if it's the right answer, is that if you started out with a quantum theory that from the beginning had an infinite number of degrees of freedom, and maybe all but some infinite subset were frozen out initially, you can imagine that as the system evolves, more and more of the frozen degrees of freedom become excited. But I don't know.
Hmm. So I think there are a number of kids who actually why this may be not
okay, okay. Okay, okay. We'll talk about them more later. I mean, certainly certainly it's a fact that any classical approximation of this sort is at best a classical approximation. Certainly this is not the full theory of the world, which should be quantum mechanical without a doubt. But we don't know how to do that, so that's not what we're talking about. But the infinities of time don't seem to have that much to do with quantum mechanics. So I think issues of the infinities of time and the infinities of the overall system and how you handle it, I think, are all present here. And this does, I think, provide a good model for studying those. And that's really what our claim is. Once you decide that this is a well-defined system, then you can proceed to talk about how you define probabilities on it. No unique answer, of course. This is still just a framework. There have been claims made that time must end, by including some people in the audience here, but Vitaly and I don't think so. And in this paper that we think we're going to get out soon, we will try to establish that claim. Merely to prove that we had confidence in the fact that time doesn't end, we've taken almost an infinite amount of time to write this paper. So we hope that that will inspire people to take us seriously. So my claim is that the multiverse is a mathematically well-defined system in the statistical sense. And we also claim that it's pretty well motivated by at least what a lot of people think string theory should be doing as a fundamental theory. So I think it makes sense to consider the properties of this infinite system and try to understand what we can. So the point I want to make is the multiverse itself you can describe absolutely unambiguously. You do not need a measure. Where you need a measure is to count the number of events that happen in the multiverse. That's where the need for the measure comes. The multiverse exists first and independent of the measure. And that, to me, makes it seem like the measure problem must have some solution. It's not really fundamental to construct the system. So somehow it's just a matter of us understanding what the system is telling us. I would say that the fact that we don't understand the measure problem should not be taken as indication that eternal inflation is off track. And I'd capsulize this in the maxim that nature is not required to behave in a way that we find easy to understand. And there's an important historical example there. There's probably many, but one that I think most often talked about is Arthur Eddington and black holes. You're probably aware that Arthur Eddington vehemently held that black holes couldn't possibly exist. And his argument about why they couldn't possibly exist was basically that if things start to collapse to a black hole, we would have no idea what would happen. So there must be something that prevents it from happening in the first place. So that's certainly a case where, in the end, it was just a matter of learning how to understand what does happen when things collapse to a black hole, rather than to assume that it's not going to happen simply because it would be difficult to understand if it did. This is my last slide. And my last slide here, I'd like to give you a kind of an historical flow argument about why eternal inflation, I think, looks good. Things have changed a lot in the last 10 or 5 or 20 years, depending on what time scale you want to look at. But we now, I think, have three different trends that have happened in physics, all coming from different origins, all of which seem to be coming together to suggest that we live in a multiverse. None of these are, of course, conclusive. I'm not claiming that they are. But they do all point in the same direction. First of all, from theoretical cosmology, we have the fact that almost all versions of inflation lead to eternal inflation. Once inflation starts, it just never stops. This is something that's more or less been known almost since the beginning of inflation. But it gets to be much more interesting when it gets combined with the other points here. So second point is that string theory, almost all string theorists, not quite, but almost all, believe that string theory has no unique vacuum, but in fact has a huge, colossal number of long-lived metastable states, any one of which can serve as the substrate for a Bucket universe. And if that's so, and if we combine that with the idea that eternal inflation produces a multiverse, we would then expect that within the multiverse, each pocket universe would choose its own vacuum. So most likely all, or at least a huge number of vacua, would be populated by the multiverse. And finally, what was a shock to me, certainly, and I think to most physicists, but not all, was the discovery a little more than 10 years ago now that our universe does not have zero vacuum energy, as we had hoped. If it did, we have to admit we don't really understand that either. But I think when we were hoping that the vacuum energy was zero, we all believed in the back of our heads that somehow there would be some symmetry argument that would get discovered next year that would explain why it was zero. A non-zero value seems harder to understand. But what was discovered is that it is non-zero. It's very small by Planck standards, on the order of 10 to the minus 120, but non-zero. And that is certainly the kind of situation that calls out for a selection effect explanation. It's exactly the sort of thing that you'd expect if it were determined by a selection effect. The cosmological constant would simply be on the order of the range of possible values it could have consistent with life. We don't really know exactly what to count as life, so there are big ambiguities there, but the selection effect argument certainly does seem like a very reasonable one. And the important point is that if we compare it with the other explanations that people have come up with, there's essentially no other explanations that people have come up with. What? Yours? Well, maybe. anyway, the anthropic explanation is certainly a very plausible one. So with these three winds all blowing in the same direction, it seems to me that we have good reason to change the orientation of our sails from the way they were pointed 10 or 20 years ago. And I think that eternal inflation and the idea of selection effects associated with eternal inflation now seems like a very reasonable view of the world that we live in. Thank you.
I'd like to criticize this argument about thermal equilibrium.
Go ahead.
So if I take a system with a finite-dimensional Hilbert space and a time-dependent Hamiltonian that asymptotes to something time-independent, you can imagine a model. I'll tell you about steps towards actually building one, in which there's an initial time-dependent period that looks like our universe as it evolved, and then you come to thermal equilibrium. And given the value of the cosmological constant, the recurrence times are incredibly long. So just as a theoretical point, you can change that model in arbitrary ways long after we've gotten to the de Sitter phase. And those arbitrary ways will change completely what the predictions are about recurrence times. More than that, Willie and I and Sonia Pabon a number of years ago, and Willie talked about this about a month ago here in Perimeter, argued that in de Sitter space, the largest machine you could build that could actually have decoherent classical observations that were detailed enough to actually be counted as measurements, the biggest machine would undergo quantum fluctuations an exponentially large number of times over one de Sitter recurrence time. And in fact, the de Sitter recurrence time is essentially the same number when it's measured in units of that quantum coherence time of the biggest possible machine as it is when measured in Planck times. So in a model like that, there seems to be no, in principle, observable consequence of all of these recurrences. And I can change the model in arbitrary ways without affecting the initial part of the universe, which is the part we see. And it won't have the recurrences, or they'll happen on a different time scale. And so I don't see what the physical argument is that a model like that is bad. Okay, these imaginary observers might or might not exist depending on how I change the model, and there's nothing in physics that allows me to actually measure their existence.
Okay. Well, I agree if you have the Hamiltonian that changes monotonically or and changes in a way that doesn't come back, then I agree you could avoid this problem. It sounds like that's what you're doing.
Well,
it seems to me that the time scales don't matter.
The point is that I can evolve to a constant Hamiltonian, come to equilibrium, but on a time scale much shorter than the recurrence time, but much longer than anything that you can in principle measure. I can now change the Hamiltonian again. And I have a different theory that looks like the original theory for every possible measurement you can ever do, but doesn't have the problem of Boltzmann's brains.
Yeah,
and I can do that in an infinite number of different ways.
Well, as long as you're there to keep changing the Hamiltonian, I agree.
Yeah,
but I don't know that anybody's there to do that. Well, you can make it so that life doesn't occur after the first cycle. You approach the equilibrium, reach it, and then change the Hamiltonian so it can't support life anymore. That seems to me to be work. It seems to me that has to work. It sounds artificial to me, but maybe you have a way of making it sound plausible.
What I think is artificial is believing in things that depend on my not making changes like that.
Oh, yeah, I mean, another thing, I mean, even if you had a finite system, if you just put the measure, even if you left the Hamiltonian completely time independent and had a finite system, if you started off in some, you know, special state, eventually it'll become thermalized and so on. But if you just put on a measure that's not time independent, then you'll run into these problems. So I think your assumption, of course, was the natural one, that we have the finite system, time independent Hamiltonian, and the measure is also time independent.
But I think it's finite, the measure is to count. But
Right. So, I mean, Tom's giving up the time-independent Hamiltonian. I'm saying you could also just give up the time-independent measure.
Yeah, I suppose. How things just not count after a certain amount of time.
Oh, am I next? I'll go ahead. So I just want to make a comment that while I agree with the comments exactly as they're stated about finite systems, I think interpreting those statements in cosmology has a lot to do with whether the degrees of freedom we see, including the microstates, are all there is, and what might be happening in other sectors. And I'll talk about that in my talk coming up in a couple of days.
Boltzmann brains. I agree with the philosophy of avoiding thermal equilibrium and Poincaré recurrences and also having an infinite Hilbert space, but I don't see how that changes the ratio of probabilities of Boltzmann brains to pocket universes. When it comes to calculating those probabilities, we are using equilibrium. We are talking about entropy and about probabilities based on that entropy. So how would we include the out-of-equilibrium dynamics and change that story? The same argument that you use to favor pocket universes can go through for Boltzmann brains. So I don't see how those are avoided.
Okay, good question. I don't think they are automatically avoided, so I think basically you're right that I didn't talk about it. I think if you have thermal recurrences, unless you have things time-dependent, as people have pointed out, then I think you're doomed to be dominated by Boltzmann brains with probability 1. In a universe that goes on evolving by eternal inflation, then it's a calculation whether or not Boltzmann brains dominate or not. And I and 5 co-authors, Andre Linde, Alex Valenkin, Norbala, DeSimone, and Salem, wrote a paper which took us also ages to write on Boltzmann brains and the scale factor cutoff measure. And even there, we were not conclusive. There's a chance that scale factor measure could be ruled out by Boltzmann brains, depending on assumptions that we didn't know for sure how to make about decay rates and Boltzmann brain nucleation rates. But at least those systems are potentially safe, depending on how the details break.
Of freedom on the H function. I mean, if we want to do out of equilibrium, we have to talk of H function. and we don't know yet how to incorporate those gravitational degrees of freedom in that function. So it's hard to see how can we make any statements about Boltzmann brains having lesser probability by simply making the Hilbert space infinite. It's not clear to me.
Yeah, well, all I was saying is it changes what is definitely a losing proposition to one where you now have to do a calculation which we don't really know how to do. And our conclusion was, I think, the same as what you're saying. We don't really know for sure whether such a universe would be safe from Boltzmann brains.
Okay, last question, Raphael.
Yeah, so I think it's sort of ironic because Neil says that eternal inflation creates all these problems in the first place, like Boltzmann brains and the early universe having low entropy. And I think you're telling us that it solves those problems. And I think you're both wrong. I think that as a friend of inflation, I guess, I'm worried about overreaching. I mean, I don't think we should say that we solve problems that we don't solve. Neither are they problems that we created. I mean, you can have a perfectly good theory in which your cosmological constant is just zero or negative to start with. And you don't have a Boltzmann brain problem. You didn't need eternal inflation to solve it. On the other hand, the model that Dyson, Cleveland, and Susskind studied is an example of eternal inflation, which does have this problem. there's not a one-to-one correlation between these things, and I think it's very useful to separate them.
That was not a question.
Did I pretend it was one? You asked.
Okay. We should break for coffee. Let's ask more for Alan over coffee. So we're going to come back here at 11:30, and let's thank Alan again.
Sure.